It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. This is Bill Corey, sports editor of the Providence Journal. With me is our Red Sox writer, Bill Koch. Bill, it has been too long, and it is certainly on me that we have not convened one of the Twin Bills for probably 3 weeks or so, and probably should have done this a little sooner. But I have to admit, Bill, my interest in the Red Sox seemed to wane a little bit over the closing weeks of the season because they looked like they were doing everything they could to not be playing in October. I'm glad I was wrong. We are sitting here on the eve of the American League Championship Series. Who'd have thunk we would have said that back in April, that the Red Sox are going to open on Friday night down in Houston. So, Bill, I'm going to start by saying that I am completely surprised that they are where they are. We started the season thinking, at least I did, that they're probably an 80-85 win team. They won 92 games in a very good division. They played other teams that were also right around 90 or more wins. They figured out how to get to the wild card, beat the Yankees in the single wild card game, and an exciting series against the Tampa Bay Rays. So mea culpa on that one, but I'm glad we are where we are, so to speak.
You all should have seen the look of pure glee in the eyes of Bill Corey when he uttered the phrase, beat the Yankees.
For me, the season ended right there. Everything else is gravy because, you know, the Red Sox have slain the Yankees once again, and whatever happens now, you know, who cares? But obviously we do care. But yeah, well, they played the Yankees where they had to play them. I did not feel good about if they had to go down to Yankee Stadium. Bad things usually happen to the Red Sox down there. But they played them up here and dispatched them pretty quickly, I think.
Home field advantage matters.
Yes, certainly.
It does, yep. When you play in big markets like, yep, this, and you have real fans like this, and you have a group just of people in society coming out of a pandemic who have largely been in their houses for the last 18 months.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they are given a reason to congregate and celebrate. Fenway Park for the wild card game was a top five crowd in my lifetime.
Wow.
At that venue.
Is that right?
It was fabulous.
You know, you make a good point. It's not only the return of postseason baseball, it's the return of postseason baseball after the pandemic.
Yes.
After that cruddy year that we endured last year, baseball-wise. It must have been electric, and obviously the game didn't hurt either.
This team also, when you compare them to 2018, we're not in awe of this team. They have flaws.
Yeah.
When they do some things right, it might be unexpected. In 2018, it seemed like they didn't have a weakness. They just rolled through everyone,
yeah.
108 wins, they crushed everyone in the playoffs.
Right, right.
And you're looking at them and thinking, just your takeaway word was wow.
Sure.
Wow.
Sure.
These guys are unbelievable. They have singular talents who came together and formed arguably the best Red Sox team we've ever seen.
And to be honest, if they didn't do what they did in the postseason in 2018, it would have been a clear disappointment after that season.
Very good.
This year, completely different, because nobody had expectations that they would get deep into the playoffs. Maybe they would get lucky and get themselves into a wild card game, but certainly, I don't think I don't remember reading too many prognosticators back in March or April saying the Red Sox are going to be playing for the American League pennant.
And I think this goes to, you know, the very core of who we are, living in New England. You know, we're cynical, we're blue collar, we're you know, we like to look at ourselves as scrappy and not necessarily as corporate as maybe New York, and maybe not as surface as folks in LA might be. You know, we sort of have that very sort of edgy, you know, kind of parochial attitude,
sure,
about us. And I think in a lot of ways that's probably why you see fans connecting with this Red Sox team,
yep,
the way they have, because it hasn't been smooth. You know, I will say, and folks can go back into the backlog of podcasts and find my predictions from the start of the year. I thought they'd go 85-77. I thought they'd be significantly improved,
yep,
from last season. I felt like Alex Cora would make a major difference on the bench. I genuinely believe that he has something special about him that, that players respond to him, not only in a baseball sense, but in a human sense. I thought Chris Sale coming back late in the year, maybe a little later than I anticipated, but still he would give them a boost on their pitching staff. Certainly felt like J.D. Martinez couldn't be that bad again, and that Rafael Devers and Xander Bogaerts would continue to emerge as the superstars they are. The bonuses here, obviously, were that Nathan Eovaldi made every start.
Which you and I both said at the beginning of the season.
It was a key to the season.
It absolutely was a key. We had all the confidence in the world in his stuff. If he was on the mound, that good things would happen. They'd have a chance to win just about every time he goes out. The big question, and because this is what Eovaldi has shown us over the years, was that how many games was he going to not be in because of whatever ailment? And he made all his starts, and this is one of the big reasons the Red Sox were able to reach 92 wins.
Far and away, their leader among the pitching staff in wins above replacement. Far, far and away.
Yep.
You know, he was fantastic. Eduardo Rodriguez wasn't great in terms of performance,
no,
but he was able to take the ball every time, which was very helpful.
Sure, yeah.
You know, you had the emergence of the two young right-handers, Tanner Houck and Garrett Whitlock. They were huge.
Sure,
Whitlock was not someone we could have seen coming. He was the most valuable member of that bullpen by far, with the stuff and the composure and the flexibility he offered Alex Cora. The ability to pitch not only in the ninth inning, but to pitch multiple innings in the sixth and the seventh and the eighth if they so felt like it.
Sure.
You know, I think in the field, you look at Renfro had a bounce back here after being non-tendered by the Rays. Kike Hernandez was a utility guy with the Dodgers. He's an everyday center fielder here.
Yep.
I think he's outperformed any projections you might have had
I mean, I think Kike Hernandez was being thought of as a second baseman when he was going to be coming to Boston, and he turned out to be a very serviceable, good outfielder.
You know? And all those things sort of came together to make them a little better than we might have anticipated. Certainly through the first 100 games. You're sitting there 63-40. You're leading the division at the trade deadline. And generally, as we've said before on the pod, once you get to 20 games over and you're on a 91-71 pace, that's generally a playoff qualifier.
Sure.
You can start to look ahead to October. What followed was them going 29-30, going 3-10 with Kyle Schwarber in the IL after you traded for an injured player.
Right.
Nathan Eovaldi admitting on WEI this morning that the players were a little disappointed in the sort of lack of marquee additions.
And you got to believe when you hear that, and he could say that now because everyone's exhaled and they've reached. So if a player comes out and says that, I'm sure they were more than a little bit upset.
I'm sure they were looking and saying,
"What the hell?
We lead the division. What are we doing?
What the hell are you guys doing? Why don't you get somebody?"
They were saying a lot of the same things we were saying.
Right.
Certainly.
But here we are, you know, and all of those teams that we gave a lot of kudos to for doing a lot at the trade deadline, and they did, the Yankees, the Blue Jays.
Atlanta,
right? So it's the Red Sox that are in the postseason, and their division rivals, you know, are not. So for what it's worth, you know, I think those moves were probably enough because they are enough. They got them here. Not to say that it wouldn't have been great to go get a young pitcher that they would have had control over for a few more years, or another batter that maybe somebody who could come in and play first base. But you know, Bobby Dalbec kind of turned it around, became a very much more consistent offensive player in the second half of the season. Robles has not been terrible. I know you're not a fan of his, but he has not been terrible. And Schwarber has been very good.
Really good.
Schwarber has been very good. Once he returned to the field, got over his hamstring injury there, has been very good for the Red Sox. So, Bill, let's talk a little bit about some of the unlikely heroes. I'm not sure how unlikely they are, but some of the unlikely heroes of the postseason. I think top of that list, obviously, is Kike Hernandez. And you know, here's a guy who clearly has had a great run in the postseason with the Dodgers, but Hernandez comes through And so does Christian Vasquez, who has not had the best of years. So, Bill, before we get any further, I'm told there's some breaking news that maybe we need some bulletin music or something.
We need some sort of break-in?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Chris Sale will start game one of the American League Championship Series for the Red Sox.
Ah, Chris Sale. Okay. Well, you know, it's a little bit of a surprise. I guess we were thinking Eovaldi was probably going to get the nod. We weren't sure how he was going to be used. You know, I guess this is a way of maybe showing some confidence in Sale. And by the same token, it's game one. So if he gets off to a rocky start, they have a little bit of a cushion.
You know, I think you might be onto something with that, actually. You know? Because if he does start and blow up in game one.
Better in game one than game three, right?
You've got the rest of your staff set up. Nathan Eovaldi will start game two.
Okay.
Alex Cora announced that.
Yep.
So Chris Sale will start on Friday.
Yep.
Nathan Eovaldi will start on Saturday. If Chris Sale blows up in game one as opposed to, say, game three, you have the rest of your staff in front of you. You can make decisions based on the rest of your staff who is fresh, who hasn't pitched yet,
right,
who hasn't been used in certain situations yet. You can say, okay, this guy will start in Sale's spot going forward. We're going to go to this guy in the bullpen. And Sale, if he blows up in an inning or two, we can use him in relief in, say, game four against a couple lefties in the Astros lineup.
Right. Right.
So in that respect, if you were going to start him, and as I wrote for the Journal, I made, you know, sort of an argument whether you should, whether you shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Game one feels like the right spot to do it.
I guess so. You know, I mean, traditionally, you want your best guy on game one, out in game one. You want to go and get that win. That first win is certainly important. But there is an argument to be made, I think, that if Sale goes out and lasts an inning or two, that you've got plenty of other options to use right then and there. Everyone is on full rest. So, a little bit of a surprise. I can't say a huge shock. So getting back to some of the unlikely heroes here, Kike Hernandez in the postseason for the Red Sox so far this year, 25 plate appearances, 10 hits. Obviously, the walk-off fly ball there to win it against the Rays is the most recent thing in memory. But he has been fantastic. And I think one of the points that we made early in the season, I remember talking about it, is if you're going to have your core guys, Xander Bogaerts, J.D. Martinez, and Rafael Devers essentially carry the offense, which they have for the most part, you still need some kind of contributions from people that you know can that you may not expect. And Kike has been all of that for them in the postseason.
You know, he looks like a man for the moment. I think a lot of performing in the playoffs is just embracing that stage.
Yep.
And Kike's got a little bit of Eddie Haskell to him.
Yeah.
You know, he's a little bit of a smart aleck.
He had a great quote. He had a great quote, which you after they won the ALDS, when he said, you know, nobody expected us to be here except us, or something to that effect.
A very, very Patriots 2003-ish.
Right.
You know, you could imagine.
Although he was a little bit more accurate than those Patriots were. Right?
You could imagine Kike, Mike Vrabel, Teddy Bruschi, and Rodney Harrison having dinner together and having a lot of the same things to say.
Right.
You know, of course, Kike comes in. He comes into the press conference. I think if you were to vote for an MVP in that series, he probably would have won it.
Sure.
He's got a bottle of champagne and he sweeps the Gatorade aside and he says, we don't need that. We just won.
Right.
You know, but he's got a little bit of that, you know, sort of extra confidence that really plays well in October.
Sure.
You know, how many times have we seen, you know, not Red Sox players, but just players in baseball in general. How many guys have we seen who are great players for 162 and then just shrink from the moment?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. And, and it's either because they press or they're trying too hard,
right?
Or it's just too much for them. You know, just draw the comparisons between Jeter and A-Rod, for example. You know, A-Rod's the better player. Certainly the better player, certainly the more talented player. The regular season numbers are what they are. Look at what Jeter was able to do in the playoffs.
Sure.
Compared to Rodriguez. You know, better in just about any statistical category you want to look at. And I think that is just largely down to who they are as people. You know, the fact that Jeter was just Mr. Cool,
yep.
ready for the moment, born to play in New York, was in a great lineup, had great support, and just went out and did his thing.
Well, there's something to be said to do it on the biggest stage. And I think that, you know, we don't want to go too far on a tangent here, but that was one of the things that, I think Curt Schilling was known for, was that when postseason came around.
Good example.
He was nails. Right. I mean, not that he was bad during the regular season, but he was elite in the postseason.
Good example.
You know, and it, maybe that's who Kike Hernandez is. I you know, that would be great, obviously, because I think, you know, you sort of know or can expect or hope to expect what you're going to get from J.D. Martinez and Bogarts and Devers. When these other guys step up, they're hard to beat.
Yeah, really tough. You know, when someone gets on a run like that, you look at what Hernandez did in Game 2 when the Red Sox turned this series. Had 4 extra base hits. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's a whole series for a lot of guys, and it would be considered a good series. Homer and 3 doubles and a 14-6 win, you know, and that's after the Red Sox get shut out in Game 1 and they get out to a considerable deficit
right.
to open Game 2, and you just think, goodness, look at this guy. You know, look at this. Just jump on his back, guys. You know, he's going to carry the rest of the way. You know, the other guy who was huge in that game, and I think, you know, this is a point you made before the podcast, this is why you pay $110 million to J.D. Martinez.
Oh, sure.
He's out absolutely. There on a yeah. bad left ankle, which he sprained in the regular season finale.
Which,
in ridiculous
oh
fashion.
Oh, my gosh. You know, you're watching that, and you're like, are you kidding me? This is how he gets hurt? And there was a question whether, you know, because we didn't know how severe it was. There was a question as to how soon he could be back. Unfortunately, you know, it wasn't that long, but he's clearly not the same guy on the bases.
The medical staff told him that if this was in May, they would have placed him on the 10-day IL.
Right.
Just
right.
to rest him.
Sure.
They wouldn't have tried to push him. But this being the postseason, Martinez said, go ahead, treat me. I'll try to play any way I can.
Yep.
He hits a 3-run homer in a 5-5 game. They end up winning 14-6.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He hits .467 in the series, which led the team. You know, not that batting average is everything, but still, he's a productive player
yeah.
in the series. He goes 2-for-4 in game 4, knocks in a run with a single off the wall, which turned out to be a huge run. It was the 5th run,
mm-hmm.
which means you're tied 5-5 into the 9th instead of trailing. You know, just guys who are meant for the moment. It feels like the Red Sox have a few of them. They certainly had a few more than the Rays did.
Yep.
You know, and I think that you just take a lot of things put together, whether it's the crowd or the nobody believes in us or
right.
Alex Cora being back or the talent that they have on the roster. I mean, they have some really good players on this team. But it takes that sort of special marriage of all of it, you know, to succeed in October. And I think, you know, in the wild card game against the Yankees and then over 4 nights against the Rays, I think the Red Sox have put that on display and given themselves a real chance to stand side by side here with the Astros.
And also, let's not forget about Xander Bogaerts, who's also been pretty solid in the postseason here. I believe he's 7-for-20. He's got a couple of home runs. Again, these are the guys that we are expecting for the Red Sox to lean on. And certainly they have been. But again, Schwarber has been a key for them, too. Again,
yeah.
somebody who has been good for them late in the season, has continued into the postseason as well. Getting contributions up and down the lineup, it's the mark of a good. You know, I'm watching that game against, I want to say it was game 2 against the Rays. And it struck me that, you know, that thing that teams have that make them look a little invincible, or that they maybe got some pixie dust or whatever you want to call it, it seemed to be showing up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I may be speaking too soon because they're going to face a very tough Houston team here. But they seem to have that look about them that, you know, whatever happens, we're going to be okay. We're going to fight back when we have to fight back, and we're going to, you know, we're not going to fold just because we're down, and they didn't.
And
you know?
More importantly, good things will happen to us, like an absolute all-timer in Game 3 against the Rays.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a play that I had never seen before, and I would imagine that you have never seen before either on the Kevin Kiermaier ground rule double that should have scored the go-ahead
Crazy.
Run, but ultimately did not.
Crazy. Absolutely right. You know, so basically a ground rule double because it bounced off of Hunter Renfro.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Which fortunately was ruled a ground rule double, and the run that had scored had to be called back to third base, and the Red Sox were able to strand the runners, which was... you need those kinds of things every now and then. You need the tuck rule, so to speak, right? You need something that you're like, oh, man, look at what a break that was. I didn't know that was a thing because, you know, obviously we all know about ground rule doubles, but I was a little unclear because it bounced off of a player. Does the umpire have some discretion? Because clearly the runner could have was going to score. The rule, as you explained, does not allow for that kind of discretion.
5.06b4h. Never forget it, Red Sox fans.
Going to have that tattooed on people's arms.
Someone is going to get that tattooed onto an arm or onto a calf or something like that if the Red Sox win the World Series. It was, as I wrote for a quick piece in next day's journal after Game 3, it was the baseball version of the tuck rule. I did not know the rule to be perfectly transparent.
Obviously, most people didn't. You could even on the game call, the announcers were a little, you know, questioning. And, gee, I wonder what's going to happen, and because you never see something like that.
The primary question that I had about the play, which was answered in the rule book, and by Sam Holbrook, who was the crew chief and the home plate umpire that night, was whether or not the umpires had any discretion.
Right.
You know, I did not know if there was language in there that gave the umpires discretion with respect to where the runners were placed.
Right. I initially thought that there was because, you know, I'd hate to be on the other side of that play because clearly the runner was going to score. You know, there was no way that Renfro, if he handled that ball cleanly, was going to throw the guy out.
No, it turns out that in 2019, the Rays were involved in a similar play against the Blue Jays at Rogers Center. And the clip came out, I think it was later that night or you know, early the next morning.
Yeah.
You know, there was a ball that was batted ball, put in play, you know, had hit the ground and was knocked into the stands by a fielder inadvertently.
Yep.
Unintentionally. Mm-hmm. Runners are granted two bases. The batter and any base runners who are aboard. And that's it.
Two base, period.
Two that's bases. It. No interpretation.
Right, so if you're on first, you get third, and there
you get
is
third.
No...
That's it.
That's it.
No. So when Kevin Cash comes out after the umpires confer and then go to video, and he's talking with Holbrook, it's about a 10-second conversation.
Yeah.
Kevin Cash, very calm the whole time. Obviously, Holbrook said, here's the rule. We have no latitude.
Sure.
It's in the book. We can't change the call.
Right.
And Cash just very calmly turned around and walked back to his dugout.
Yeah.
You know, in the post game afterwards, very measured in his comments, he said, look, the rule is the rule. We can revisit the rule in the offseason. Maybe it needs to be changed. I don't know. Maybe you want some judgment language in there. But the way they applied it tonight was cut and dried.
Yeah.
They had no recourse. And this, of course, becomes a discussion because it's a 3-2 pitch from Nick Pivetta and with two outs, and Yandy Diaz is running from first.
Yep.
And Yandy Diaz is already rounding second and would have scored easily in a 4-4 game in the 13th inning.
Yep.
There was nothing intentional about what Renfro did. The ball caroms off him. It goes into the bullpen.
Right.
He puts his palms up and says...
Ball's out of play.
The ball's out of play.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting up there in the press box and I'm thinking... I saw the play clearly. I heard the ball hit the wall. I have never seen the ball go out of play on something like that. What I immediately assumed was that the umpires would have discretion.
Sure.
You know, and then somebody posted the rule on Twitter, and the rule was very clear-cut about two bases for the batter and any base runners. I didn't see any wiggle room there.
Right.
So while they're on the video monitor, I'm thinking to myself, Diaz is going back to third.
Hmm.
They're not going to allow him to score.
Yeah.
This is just, it's very clear. You know, the umpires have,
right.
They don't have any latitude here. And sure enough, Holbrook takes the headset off, points to third base, points to second base. Kiermaier gives him a look like,
yeah, look, what are you talking about?
Oh, man,
about?
Really?
Right.
Really? Like that? Like that's...
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of like, what, Mom, no ice cream after dinner?
Yeah.
Like, really? Come on, I've been a good kid all week. Like, you really going to tell me what kind of ice cream now? Like, it was just... it was tough to watch if you're a Rays fan, you know, because you knew what the outcome of the play would have been.
Right.
And any reasonable assessment of the play would have told you that Diaz would have scored. But that sort of thing just wasn't allowed.
Yeah, and the Red Sox, to their credit, got the final out in the inning.
Well, that's right.
You know, it wasn't like the inning ended and you know, the Rays still had a runner on third base and you know, weren't able to bring him home.
Nope, they had Mike Zunino coming, who wound up 0 for 7. I was actually, you know, if you're really going to, like, you know, play the numbers there or really think about, you know, trying to go deep into, like, you know, the recesses of the box score and whatever else.
Right.
Cash could have hit Francisco Mejia there from the left side against Pivetta, right. You know, because Zunino isn't out at that point.
He has been.
Like, he isn't out.
He certainly has been, yeah.
Like, it's not, like, you know, you're sending him up there, and yeah, you're in the Rays dugout, and you're thinking, all right, you know, Mike is our guy, and, like, he's going to come through there, and, you know, he's a veteran and all that stuff. Like, but in your heart of hearts, you know, man, this guy's an out. Mm-hmm. Like this isn't going to happen. Right. There's no way. You know, he ends up going 2 for 15 in the series with 6 strikeouts. You know, and you're just thinking, like, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
There's no way he's going to get a hit. And there's no way that Pivetta is going to throw him something that he can hit. And he ends up throwing him a high fastball and he swings through it.
Right.
At that point, you go to the bottom of the 13th and you're like, well, the Red Sox really get away with something
yeah,
here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're certainly going to win now, right?
Yeah. Well, they did.
And it goes back to your initial point that started this tangent, which was when things like that happen. The teams that end up winning in the playoffs,
yeah,
they get the benefit of those things, and then they immediately take advantage of those
things. They capitalize on them, absolutely. And they did. And they did with Christian Vasquez, who, you know, he has not had a great season for the Red Sox. Certainly fell off what he had been doing offensively. I think he hit maybe 250, 260 for the season or something like that. But in the postseason here, he's played... played very big roles in their last two victories. He obviously the walk-off home run. And then in the game four, he let off that final inning with a single and was pinch run for it, I believe, at the end there. But he got it going again.
You know, he also let off the fifth with a single.
That's true. Yep.
Sorry, the third with a
early
single.
In the game,
and that was a 5-run inning. You know, that was all their scoring until the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah.
So two real big at-bats. They're actually three. I mean, obviously, if you go back to the home run, three real big at-bats over the course of the last two nights for Vasquez. And you're looking at how he's been used and what the Red Sox are doing here in terms of their matchups. It's pretty clear that Plawecki is going to catch Eovaldi.
Yeah.
And Plawecki is only going to be in the game while Eovaldi's in the game. And that's largely because Plawecki can't control the running game. This season, opposing base stealers were 34 for 37 against them.
Right.
So you get into the late innings, and you have a team like Tampa, who is athletic, who has a handful of guys who could go if they felt like it.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go to Vasquez at that point. And even though, you know, guys like Margot and Wander Franco can steal bases against Vasquez as well, you know, and he's not like the second coming of Pudge Rodriguez. He's still an improvement. He can still handle the entirety of your bullpen.
Yep.
You know, and he had a couple big at-bats late in games where, you know, thankfully, if you're the Red Sox, he came through in stunning fashion.
Absolutely. So before we jump into to our next bit here, we should at least talk about some of the great pitching performances that we saw so far in the postseason. Chief among them, I think, Garrett Whitlock for the Red Sox. Pivetta, as you just mentioned, has been huge for them in the postseason. And Eovaldi, who, you know, we're just kind of used to him being really good, has continued to be really good. I think those three guys, and you want to throw Eddie Rodriguez in there. He had a good start there last night.
I'll put Tanner Houck in there, too.
Tanner Houck, that's right. You know, they're the reason the Red Sox were able to, you know, save a blowed up Chris Sale, keep them in the game and give that Vasquez a chance to win the game there. Pitching, especially from those three guys, Whitlock, Eovaldi, and Pivetta, have been great.
Significant relief stints throughout this series. And go all the way back to game one, which, you know, Cora highlighted a little bit during the workout day on Wednesday.
Yep.
the fact that Rodriguez is ineffective, he only gets five outs. You go to Richards for one out in the second. Pivetta gives you 4 2/3.
Yeah.
Now, you end up losing the game, and he leaked a couple runs at the end. But what that performance allowed was for you to not blowtorch the rest of your bullpen.
Absolutely.
Right away.
Right.
In the first game of the series. So the next night, when Sale is poor in the first inning and Jordan Luplow hits a grand slam, you have Tanner Houck to go to for five innings.
Absolutely.
You haven't used him for an inning or two the night before. You know, because you haven't had to go to nine guys just to get 24 outs in a game where you're losing 18-3 or something ridiculous like that.
Right.
You know, and then I think, you know, Houck was fantastic. They win that game. They turn the series. It's 1-1. And then Cora, fittingly, in a game three, because he did this before in a game three in 2018 in the World Series, he goes all in.
Yeah.
He goes all in. He smells a spot where the series could turn for good. And he takes his game four starter, Nick Pivetta.
And Pivetta on 2 days rest at this point.
And he brings him in the 10th inning of a 4-4 game. And at that point, you're thinking, okay, this either works or it doesn't.
Worked.
There's no, as my dad always said, and he got this from a high school friend, it's either going to be an A or an F.
Right. There's no Bs.
No Bs, no Cs. It's going to be an A or an F.
Yeah.
You're either going to win the game or you get into the 13th inning, Kiermaier's double knocks in a run, you lose 5-4, and now you have no idea what you're going to do for the next day. You're down 2-1. You have no game four starter. You just used him.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now?
Right. Hello, Martin Perez,
Martin Perez or bullpen game or whatever it is.
Right.
Instead, Pivetta is fantastic. He gives you four scoreless. He strikes out seven. Most importantly, he gets Zunino and gets out of the 13th, and Vasquez walks it off. Now you go to game four. You go back to Rodriguez, who gives you 15 outs in the game. He pitches into the sixth inning, much in the same way he did in game four against the Dodgers.
Yep.
He gives up a three-run homer to Yasiel Puig, you know, and ultimately he leaves on the hook. He would have lost that game if Los Angeles hadn't melted down.
Right.
But what did he do in a 2-1 series where he has the lead, you have the lead? He's given the rest of your pitching staff a chance to sort of perform in traditional roles and not get crushed based on workload. So in game four, when he pitches into the sixth inning and he turns it over to the bullpen, you know, which ultimately faltered, but we can get into that in a minute.
Mm.
He's given them a chance to sort of set something up, to plan some things, to maybe match up a little bit at the end. They're not making moves out of desperation.
Right.
And he's also preserved something for game five. He hasn't gone one out, and just with the one rest day, you have to go back to Tampa, and you've used eight guys, and what are we going to do? You know, so I look at those long relief stints, Pivetta, Houck, Pivetta again.
Yeah.
Those really set up the entire series.
Absolutely. For not only their performance, but saving the bullpen for a future performance. Bill, I want to take a quick look here at the roster of the Red Sox and ask you, so who gets most of the credit here? Does Chaim Bloom get the credit for where this team is, or do you still have to give Dave Dombrowski a lot of credit? Because realistically, there's a lot of players on this team that were here because of Dombrowski, who's been gone two seasons now.
Oh boy, are we really going to do this?
We're
going to
spend
right
5 minutes on it. We're not going to.
We could do 50.
I know, but we're going to spend five.
Okay, so, I mean, are they in the ALCS without both men? The answer is absolutely no. You needed the contributions of both.
Sure.
Certainly.
So let's do a quick rundown of the inventory, so to speak.
Sure.
So Xander Bogaerts is here because Dave Dombrowski signed him.
Signed him to a 6-year, $120 million extension. Although in large part, you have to give some credit to Bogaerts for that too.
Absolutely.
He wanted to stay here. He took a below-market deal.
Yes.
I think ultimately when he opts out of his deal after 2022, he is not taking the discount.
Right.
At that point.
Right.
You have a shortstop free agency bonanza coming up, partly led by Carlos Correa, who you will see in this upcoming series.
Sure.
But you got Corey Seager out there, Trevor Story out there, Javier Baez. You know, it is going to be fascinating to see how the market continues to be reset in the wake of $300 million contracts given to Francisco Lindor and Fernando Tatis Jr.
Right.
Xander Bogaerts is wildly underpaid.
Oh, absolutely.
When you compare him to his peers.
Right.
And he's going to be even more wildly underpaid by the end of the next offseason.
Still, he was here, signed by Dombrowski.
He was here. Dombrowski was proactive.
And correct. Absolutely. Nathan Eovaldi.
Yeah. You know, 4 years, $68 million after the World Series win. In 19, he has bone chips in his elbow. He has surgery. He's out for a significant amount of time.
Right.
20 is a totally lost year for the team.
Yep.
He has a calf problem. I think he made 9 starts,
right.
I want to say, over 60 games. But this year, he's come good. And if you look at his postseason ERA, all of his appearances have been with the Red Sox. It's sub 2.
Hmm.
He's fabulous. You know, and you add on the fact that not only is he a good pitcher in the playoffs, but who's been more unselfish on their staff?
Oh, yeah.
He gives up a World Series start, which guys dream about,
right.
for you know, from the time they're in Little League, signs with them. Decides he's going to pitch in relief in 2018. He's just like, you know, oh, sure.
Do whatever.
I'll come in relief.
Do whatever you need, right.
You know, and now in this series, in the ALDS, you know, it just comes right out. He's good. You know, you're just like, I mean, he's just everything you could want.
Right.
In a pitcher. He's great in the wild card game against the Yankees. You just, you feel really good about him out there. And he's one of those guys who, and you made this allusion earlier, he's proven to be one of those guys who outperforms the regular season once October shows up.
Sure, absolutely. And of course, J.D. Martinez is here because of Dave Dombrowski. And you made a good point during the ALCS, ALDS, you know, we have J.D. Martinez and the Tampa Bay Rays don't.
And the Tampa Bay Rays...
And they would never have J.D. Martinez.
The Tampa Bay Rays or someone with Rays DNA running an organization, that could be Andrew Friedman, yeah. That could be Zaidi with the Giants, that could be Click with the Astros, that could be Chaim Bloom, would not pay $110 million for a designated hitter.
They wouldn't be able to, really.
But it's not value.
Right.
It's not value. You're basically talking about a one-way player.
Mm-hmm.
Not a guy who is also going to play the outfield and play reasonable defense, yeah. and whatever else. They would look and say, we can get someone who can give you 85% of his production for 25% of the money.
Yeah. And not trip over second base.
Right. Right. And will, yeah, who's not a danger to himself in the outfield and running out to the outfield.
Oh.
You know, but they make different value judgments in terms of their payroll.
And, sure.
You know, even the Dodgers, who print their own money, you know, they wouldn't sign J.D. Martinez to that kind of contract.
Right.
There's no way.
Right.
You know, they're signing Mookie Betts. You know, they signed Cody Bellinger. You know, Kershaw. You know, they have some big money deals on their books.
Yep.
But those are more of what you would say are complete players. Martinez, I think a lot of teams would look and they would say, you know, the DH is going to be like a day off position for us. We can get reasonable offensive production if we take a regular and we just get him off his feet and not have him play the field that day.
Right, right.
Dave Dombrowski looked and said the Red Sox were, I think they were last in the American League in home runs in 2017.
In 17, yes.
Here's the premium bat on the market.
Sure.
Here's the guy who lengthens the lineup. We put him in the middle. We think Devers and Bogaerts are going to be stars. Betts is an MVP caliber player. You put him in the middle of all that. What you don't know at the time is that it's going to be great with those guys off the field as well in terms of video, in terms of analyzing their swings,
right.
In terms of just talking, hitting with them and being the consummate professional.
Like another hitting coach.
He's been great for them in that way. You know, but that's not a contract that a lot of these organizations now who have turned to, you know, different sort of thinking of how to build a roster. I think it's a very short list of teams who would assign him to that deal.
Sure. Absolutely. So to look at some of Bloom's greatest hits, so to speak.
Well, Garrett Whitlock, number one.
Number one, sure. Obviously.
I mean, my goodness.
Just because he's from the Yankees, he gets extra points, right?
It's incredible.
right.
You know, and just think, Garrett Whitlock, in my mind, is going to be a starter in 2022.
Could be, yeah.
So not only have you gotten incredible value from a relief pitcher who can do just about anything out of the bullpen. Long relief, close, seventh inning, right, left. He throws strikes. He doesn't beat himself. Now you might have a starting pitcher.
Yeah, close to the top. Right. He could be a two or three starting pitcher for you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, Whitlock absolutely heads the class. But
and I think I've said this to you before.
Yeah.
Chaim Bloom could be he could be the chief baseball officer in Boston for the next 20 years. He might not make a better move than Garrett Whitlock.
You need to get... I don't want to say just get lucky because that makes it sound like there's no skill there. He certainly recognized talent, but nobody saw that coming.
I mean, there might not be a better one when you consider cost, when you consider he's stolen from the Yankees, when you consider they're in the ALCS. I mean, he threw the last pitch against New York. He threw the last pitch against Tampa.
Nice, yes.
Potentially he's going to throw the last pitch against Houston, you would think, if... You know, if this thing goes a certain way, he could end up throwing the last pitch of the World Series. I think that is number one, and that will take some beating.
Well, there's nobody else on this team that's going to beat that. But there have been other worthy pickups. Nick Pivetta has proven himself.
A heist at last year's trade deadline.
Yep.
You get Pivetta. You also get Connor Siebold, who, you know, had a sort of a difficult year, was injured at the start, made his debut with Boston, but, didn't necessarily have the season that you would have hoped he would have had at Worcester. But Pivetta for Workman and Hembree.
Right, who did nothing after they left.
Nothing.
Right.
A total steal. I think just the consummate, and we see this in every sport, the consummate change of scenery guy. Mm. He talks about his time in Philadelphia, and he, you get the sense, whenever he talks about his development with the Phillies, his usage with the Phillies, he is holding back.
Mm.
He's being a professional in public. I get the sense that if you were out with Nick Pivetta and you were at home with him in Canada and, maybe you had that second glass of Canadian whiskey,
right?
That Nick Pivetta would have a lot to say about his time with the Phillies.
You know, I think a World Series ring might also unlock some of that restraint, too.
You think maybe in the duck boats we'd get the Phillies Chronicles from Nick Pivetta?
Well.
What were these morons doing to me?
That's not like typical Canadians are not like that. They're usually very nice people.
He's a very nice guy.
They're not going to trash talk, but I'm sure there's some truth to what you're saying, that he's probably, doing this with a chip on his shoulder, saying, I can't believe they gave up on me. Look what I'm doing now.
Well, right? I mean, and this is my career. I have a very limited time to be a baseball player when you consider the totality of my life. So you're going to debut me as a starter and then jerk me around and put me in the bullpen and then start me again and whatever else. If you feel like you're not being used in a way that you are most effective and your performance is suffering, who else are you supposed to take it out on?
Yeah.
You're thinking, man, the organization really. And then you come to Boston and you're a worthwhile player.
Sure.
Really Absolutely. Good player.
Absolutely.
Important guy on this team. You have to be thinking, man, if it was only like this 3 or 4 years ago, my career would be so different.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now.
So, and three other guys that I definitely want to mention, because I don't know that the expectations were that high when they came here, but have all proven to be key members of the Red Sox success. That is Kike Hernandez, who we've talked about, Hunter Renfro, who had a much better season than most people would have expected.
Yep.
And Schwarber.
Yeah.
And you and I were both critical of Chaim Bloom for not doing enough at the trade deadline. But, Schwarber, once he got on the field, has been good.
Yeah, Schwarber's been really good.
Yeah.
Schwarber is, I think the thing I appreciate most about Schwarber was his reaction the other night at first base after he made an error. The next play he made. Where he flips to the pitcher covering, fist pumps, puts his hands in the air, takes his hat off and tips it to the crowd. Right. And this is after throwing a parachute ball into the Red Sox on deck circle, trying to make an underhand flip from essentially the right field grass.
Right. To be fair, he's not like he's played a lot of first
base. He's not a
in
first baseman at all.
Right.
He's not a fit for the position. Yeah. Everyone knew it when they made the trade.
Right.
You know, and you're thinking, geez, you know, why are they doing this? They need a first baseman.
Yep.
I wasn't in the Anthony Rizzo camp, as everybody knows.
Sure.
I'm not bringing an anti-vaxxer onto this team. And sure enough, they had a COVID outbreak right after that.
Right.
You know, but I, you know, Schwarber wasn't an obvious fit. And defensively, he makes them worse.
Yes.
Which is hard to do because Bobby Dalbec hasn't been great at first base. Mm-hmm. They're last in the big leagues, according to Fangraphs, in defensive runs above average at first base.
Right.
But Schwarber has a great sense of humor. He doesn't take himself too seriously. He's been part of the curse breakers with the Cubs in 2016.
Right.
He gives great balance to the lineup as a left-handed bat. You look at the first six now, and you think J.D. Martinez is hitting sixth in the ALDS. Pretty good depth.
Pretty good.
There.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the other guys you mentioned there, obviously Hernandez has a relationship with Cora,
mm-hmm.
Both from Puerto Rico. Cora knows him very well. Hernandez was the bat boy on Cora's winter ball team when he was 8 years old.
Right.
You know, his father is a longtime scout in Puerto Rico, very well regarded in Major League Baseball circles. So you get a guy who's sort of a baseball lifer there, a grinder, a little bit of a dirt dog.
Yeah.
If you're looking to turn it around off a bad season, that's good personality to bring in.
Yeah, that's good stock to have in the locker room.
You know, and then Renfro, obviously, Bloom had previous experience with Renfro with the Rays.
Tampa Bay.
You know, Tampa.
And he had a terrible year down there.
He was brutal last year. Tampa non-tenders him.
Yeah, they got him for nothing.
They got him for $3.1 million
on
a one-year deal.
Yeah.
You still have arbitration control
over
him. So you're looking at Hernandez and Renfro this year for $10 million.
Yeah, pretty good.
That's where you go back to Martinez and you say, why are we paying Martinez 22?
Yeah.
You know, that's when you are an executive and you sort of have this modern baseball DNA.
Right.
You look and say, we're paying Martinez twice plus. Why can't we just get four guys like Hernandez and mix and match and play different positions?
Yeah.
And then we'll have, you know, maybe one huge contract on the roster,
right?
Maybe two. Everyone else, though, we're going to have no middle class. Everyone else is going to be rookies, or they're going to be guys who we think are bargains,
right.
On the market.
Pick them up off the scrap heap. Well, you know, I don't know that you could count on those guys having enough of those guys on a given roster to have the kind of success this team has had. I mean, for one, still believe that you need J.D. Martinez and Xander Bogaerts and Nathan Eovaldi and Chris Sale, although Chris Sale has not really been a big contributor to do what this team has done. And I will say this about Chaim Bloom. It was no secret that he was brought in because the Red Sox wanted to pull back on salary and payroll.
Right.
And to that extent, I think he has maximized the dollars that he was sort of allowed to spend.
Yep.
But I think the biggest pickup that he has made is not any of these players that we've mentioned. It's Alex Cora.
Yeah.
And it was a bit of a surprise for a few reasons. One is, you know, I thought Alex Cora, if not done forever, probably not a manager for a few years.
Mm.
You know, maybe gets picked up as a bench coach or hitting coach, something, as an assistant on somebody else's staff. But, you know, they had an interview in the offseason. Cora wows him. And Bloom, to his credit, hires somebody who's, you know, not really his guy. But, I think that we all know how effective Alex Cora is at communicating. And I think once he gets into the postseason, he really shines. And you know, it's not there. I'll admit, I'm not sitting there watching these games when he's pulling out, you know, the pitchers when he's pulling them out saying, oh, great job, Alex. It's quite the opposite. It's like
when he pulled Eovaldi in the wild card game.
Like, what are you doing?
Right.
You know, but it, you know, how do you argue with the kind of success he's had? And you reminded me of this as we walked into the studio. He hasn't lost a postseason series with the Red Sox.
He's 15-4. In 19 games as Red Sox manager in the postseason.
Yeah.
They have won all four series they have participated in, and they have beaten the Yankees in a wild card game.
Yeah.
So five elimination scenarios, the Red Sox have survived in all five.
Right. So at some point, the manager gets credit for that.
That sort of thing doesn't just happen.
Right.
And we've seen a lot of talented teams who haven't won in October.
Yeah.
You know, for whatever reason, it hasn't worked. There have been decisions that haven't worked. There have been players who have underperformed. You know, there have been clear mismatches on paper where you look and you say, well, goodness, you know, this can't be. I mean, I go back to the probably two of the greatest ones in my lifetime. They both involve the A's. 88 against the Dodgers.
Yep.
L.A. is nowhere near the team that, Oakland was.
Sure.
And the Dodgers beat them in one game, essentially. The Kirk Gibson walk-off is such a stomach punch to the A's, you know, that Oakland never recovered.
They couldn't, yeah.
And Oral Hershiser obviously was brilliant in that series.
Right.
And then in 90 against the Reds. Cincinnati was a good team in hindsight. You know, they had Barry Larkin and Eric Davis and Chris Sabo, and they had the Nasty Boys in the bullpen.
Right. It,
very much a modern bullpen.
Yep.
Three guys throwing 100 miles an hour with Charlton, Myers, and Dibble. You know, but they weren't anyone's idea of a favorite against Oakland. They swept them.
Yep.
Jose Rio basically donated his right elbow to that series. He was never the same again.
Right.
But in his two starts, he was fantastic.
Yep.
A fastball slider guy, hard thrower for anyone who wants to look up his numbers on Baseball Reference. He was a really good pitcher in the late 80s, early 90s. You know, so I look at the Sox and I think, you know, sure. They might be playing teams who won more games than them. I remember in 18, I didn't think they'd win the ALCS against Houston. I thought they were better. But they just have a little something about them. I know Garrett Whitlock said the other day, and this is obviously his first time playing for Cora. You know, someone asked what it's been like to play for him, and he said, I'd run through a wall for Alex. He said, and I would do it because I'd be convinced that the wall would either disintegrate or he'd have something set up for the wall to fall down, and I wouldn't get hurt.
Right.
He said, that's the kind of guy he is. He cares about us, but he's also a planner. Like, he can do things, and he can explain things to us in a way that we understand and that we think will work. And sure enough, they do.
Yep.
You know, bringing him back, I remember when he, you know, was asked to step aside by the Red Sox. They called it a mutual parting. It was, you know, whatever.
Right.
We're not going
to
trip over the language.
Right,
now.
Right. They got rid of him.
You know, right.
Right.
He's suspended for the year. Yeah. I remember saying at the time that I thought the World Baseball Classic eventually could be a way back in. You know, he could manage Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
Certainly they would do well because they have a lot of talent there.
And seemed reasonable that, like, that's sort of how we would kind of take that entrance and make that first step. But it didn't take that long.
No. And I think, you know, going back to the Bloom-Dombrowski debate, I think Cora being here, I have a great amount of appreciation, and this is growing, actually, as I think about it, as I sit here. I have a great amount of appreciation for how self-assured Chaim Bloom is. I don't have anything approaching his confidence.
I think you have to be that way to be in that position, because there are people like you and me and fans that are questioning every one of your moves all season long.
But I think he, even among that group of top baseball executives, I think he's uncommon. You think about the first major move he made in Boston. What was it?
He got rid of...
he traded Mookie Betts.
Yeah. And Price.
You know, and he did it largely to move Price's contract and because Betts wasn't going to re-sign and because that well was already poisoned by, you know, not necessarily Dombrowski, but Henry and Werner.
Sure. They weren't going to ante up, right.
They made him a contract offer that they thought was reasonable. They tried to make the best deal, not the best offer. Betts was insulted. He wanted something closer to Trout. You know, and at that point, it was pretty obvious that he wasn't going to stay. It wasn't even like it here. I know that's the common narrative.
Okay.
It was that the Red Sox tried to lowball him a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
You know, $300 million, yeah, it's a lot of money. But is it what he's worth?
Yeah, well, clearly not.
No, it's not.
He got more than that.
No, it's not. He got more.
Yeah.
You could offer the Sox $1 billion for the team, and you could say, man, $1 billion is a lot of money.
Right.
Is that what the team's worth?
Not according to Forbes.
Not at all.
Right.
Not even close. It's worth about three times that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the whole, oh, we offered him a lot. No, stop. That's a red herring.
Yeah.
But what does Bloom do? He trades Mookie Betts and David Price. He basically presides over a total teardown in 2020. I mean, they were dreadful.
Yeah.
They were. But he made some really good moves at that trade deadline. He sort of built ahead for the future. And then he hires a manager who everyone knows is ownership's guy. John Henry likes Alex Cora. Yeah. Tom Werner likes Alex Cora. Sam Kennedy likes Alex Cora.
Yeah.
Bloom works for them. He might not have been Bloom's first choice going into the process. He might have preferred Will Venable. He might have preferred Sam Fult. You know, there could have been some guys that, we didn't even hear about who we might have liked to interview. I thought, you know, and it turns out he has a non-compete clause with the Rays for 2 years. I thought he might have talked to Matt Quatraro, who's the bench coach for Kevin Cash.
Right.
Because I'm sure they've had conversations about how you'd like to run a team.
Yeah.
But he hires someone who essentially makes him the only outsider from the 2018 World Series team. Bloom's basically the only change in that front office now.
Yes.
It is still Henry, Werner, Kennedy.
Yeah. And now Cora.
Eddie Romero, Brian O'Halloran, Raquel Ferreira are all still there.
Right.
Been there for a long, long time. Now you bring back the field manager who won a title with those teams. So if you're not winning in the next, you know, couple years and you're a Boston Red Sox fan, what's the only change from the outside?
Right. Who's the new guy?
Who's
right.
the new guy?
Yeah.
It's Chaim Bloom.
Sure.
You know, so I think him bringing back Cora and almost in a way, in terms of public perception anyway, further isolating him himself from that 2018 team, you know, further making himself the outlier. It's not, quote unquote, his manager.
Right, right.
I thought that took a huge amount of gravitas to do in hindsight.
Well, it takes guts. Absolutely. It takes guts because you're right. You're not picking your guy. You're not, you know, you're not going and starting fresh with the person that you feel would be most loyal to you. I mean, here's somebody who has been loyal to that front office. But, you know, in hindsight, here they are. They've won 90 plus games and are
in the ALCS for the 12th time since 1975.
Right. So how do you argue with that? It's very hard to argue with that.
Can't.
Right.
You can't. It's worked. And
right.
And regardless of what happens in this series, you have to say 2021 for the Red Sox is a success.
Oh, absolutely.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's hard to say that if they lose in such a disappointing way, it leaves a bad taste in your mouth. But the fact that they've won this many games, the fact that they've extinguished the Yankees and now the Rays, the 100-win Rays, and get to the ALCS, it can't not be a success.
No.
Before we've got a few minutes left, and before we call it a day here, Bill, we should probably talk about the team that they're going to be playing in the ALCS, and that is the very same team that Alex Cora came from, and the Houston Astros. It's the team that he was the bench coach for, and that the sign stealing scandal was basically laid right at his doorstep, and that's the one that caused him to be let go by the Red Sox and suspended by Major League Baseball, and here they are back. He's going back to Houston, so there's quite a bit of familiarity here between Cora and the Astros. But the Astros are a pretty good team. So, sweeping all that aside, just baseball wise, this is not going to be an easy task.
No, this is the best offense in baseball. I think you would say.
Yep.
You know, you look at the numbers and what they do against right-handed pitching, left-handed pitching. Really doesn't matter. They don't discriminate. They hit everybody.
Yeah.
A fifth straight LCS appearance. First time that's happened since Atlanta in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one other team who's done that, and that was Oakland in the early 70s.
Yep.
When they had, you know, Joe Rudy and Reggie Jackson and Invita Blue.
And they won three World Series in a row, I think.
Right. Yep. Fabulous team, a generational team. You know, one of the teams you look at in baseball history and say that's one of the great runs of all time.
Yeah. But yeah, you look at this Astros lineup, and you've got you know, Altuve and Correa and Bregman and Yuli Gurriel and Brantley. It's a very solid top to bottom lineup.
You've seen these guys before in 2018. Now they sprinkle in Yordan Alvarez, who is an absolute monster.
Yep.
Kyle Tucker's had a breakout season this year. You know, those guys give them a little balance from the left side. You know, it's not just Brantley anymore. who's trying to hit left-handed.
Right.
You know, Tucker and Alvarez are both better than Josh Reddick was in 2018.
Oh, yeah.
So you're,
right.
You know, you're much improved in terms of, you know, what you're getting out of outfield production and in terms of your balance in your lineup. You know, you're looking at a team here that is very different in the pitching staff. You know, you got Verlander is hurt, out for the year. Greinke is nowhere near what he was, you know, three or four seasons ago.
Right.
They have brought through young talent on that staff, and you're going to see it on display probably the first three nights of this series. Framber Valdez is going to start game one.
Yep.
Tough lefty, great curveball. You know, fastball has enough stick on it where you have to respect him.
Yep.
Luis Garcia is a guy who hadn't pitched above A ball, I think, until last season.
Wow.
They plucked him out of the alternate site, threw a really good game against the Red Sox in a series at Houston in early June. You know, isn't necessarily going to overpower you. He's a guy who changes speeds and, you know, sort of fools around and has a very unconventional windup.
Yeah, pitched to a 3.3 ERA this season.
He's very solid.
Yeah.
You know, you were also probably going to see Jose Urquidy in this series. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy who they've had in their pipeline for a while. You know, someone who's gotten innings for them, you know, over the last two or three seasons.
Yep.
One guy you might not see is Lance McCullers, which could be a big loss.
That could, yeah.
For Houston,
that,
you know,
could help.
He's got what they're describing as a forearm strain. He suffered that in game four against the White Sox. He started on short rest, and you wonder if that might have been a tipping point for him.
Yep.
He might not pitch in this series. If that's the case, that's a big loss.
That's
for
an
Houston.
Opening. Absolutely. That's an opening.
It is.
For the
that's
Red Sox. Yep.
That's their most veteran starter.
Yep.
You know, if they have to give Greinke the ball for like a game four, for example. I mean, he's just nowhere close to who he was and what he's been.
Right, right.
You know, so you'd be really interested to see what sort of contingency plan they'd have there. But those front three guys are really good.
Yep.
You know, and the lineup is just elite. I mean, you hit on a few of the guys here. You know, I think a lot of the debate over whether or not Chris Sale should start in this series in any way, for me, was the fact that these guys are so effective against left-handed pitching.
Right, right.
Bregman has a 981 career OPS against lefties. Altuve's 878. That's mashing.
Sure.
Correa hits everybody. Gurriel hits everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, the lineup is the best lineup that they could face, and that's all due respect to the Dodgers and to the Giants.
Yeah.
These guys are a real problem to solve, 1-9.
Stiff test, and I remember sitting here in 2018 when they had to play Houston, and I didn't see how they got past that team. They did, but as you pointed out, this team could actually be a little bit better. Certainly offensively could be a little bit better. So
yeah, I think they are.
You know, and so this is going to be no easy task. But we'll see. You know, we'll see. Sometimes teams surprise you, as this team has done so far since late September, when they had to win those games to get to the postseason, then they found a way to win them.
Yeah, you know, you look at Houston a little further. Could they spring a leak in the bullpen? Possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, Ryan Pressly's pretty good. Been around for a while.
Yeah,
it's got some miles on.
Yeah, he's not like a lockdown. Oh my God, it's Ryan Pressly, but he's pretty good.
You know, how do you feel about like Yimi Garcia and Kendall Graveman setting him up? Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, you'll see Ryan Stanek out there, Phil Maton out there. They're very right-handed out of the bullpen.
Yep.
You know, it could prompt the Red Sox to carry Travis Shaw in this series. I think he would have been on the roster anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but maybe a left-handed bat off the bench. Certainly you would think that puts Danny Santana on this roster again.
Right, right.
You know, another guy who can hit left-handed off the bench potentially.
Yep.
You know, I think the Red Sox will be thinking about that because Houston is, you know, really among their starters as well. I mean, Valdez is left-handed, but if you have Greinke get a surprise start, you're very right-handed there too.
Sure, sure.
You know, so maybe that's, you know, what you look at and say they don't have great balance on the pitching staff.
Yeah, maybe that's.
It's certainly not the level their offense is.
Right. Right.
You know, but this I would say this is the best team that they have played. It's probably the toughest team in the American League. I think these guys are better than the Rays, regardless of, you know, win totals or whatever else.
Right.
And I also get the sense that, they're sort of gearing up, you know, maybe for a little bit of a last ride here. You know, obviously you've got Verlander and Greinke are free agents. I don't know if they'd sign one of them to like a one-year prove-it deal for next year. Correa is a free agent and is going to make a mint on the market. They let George Springer walk previously. I don't know if they can pay Correa going forward. Martin Maldonado would be a free agent after this year. I'm not sure what he would cost, but I'm sure he wouldn't be cheap to keep, you know, because he is a good defensive catcher. Garcia and Graveman were both trade deadline ads. They were rentals. They'll be free agents, so they'll have to do some rebuilding in the bullpen as well. But Correa is the big piece, obviously.
Right.
He's the leader of this team. He's a former number one pick. You know, a guy who looks like he's put his back troubles in the rearview mirror in 2018. I know he's playing that series hurting.
Yeah.
Altuve was battling a knee injury and really struggled, you know, the last three or four games of that series.
Right.
You know, and the Red Sox were able to pick them off. I see them as ascending right now. What they did to the White Sox was really impressive.
You know, I also get the sense that they can't wait to show people that, yeah, we don't need to bang on the damn the barrels.
The trash can, yeah.
The trash cans, right?
Right.
To win. And, you know, they weren't able to get it done last year. So I think that's going to play a factor in you. Obviously, you're doing it against Alex Cora's team, and Cora was an integral part of that. So the Astros have been hearing it all season long, obviously. And I think that's added fuel to the fire. And I think... you know, I think it just makes them want to go out there and win even more.
You know, these two teams played in the division series in 2017. They played in the LCS in 2018.
Right.
I was at the LCS. I was at all five games. The crowds were into it. You know, Houston, they close the roof and it gets loud in there. Fenway, obviously, is great for any playoff game.
Yeah.
But I actually think this time around you're going to see a different level. I think there's going to be a different amount of venom among both fan bases. And I think it has less to do with the third meeting in 5 years and more to do with the fact that Houston's the villain.
Yeah.
They're the wrestling heel. And they're willing to wear the black hat. They don't care for 5 seconds.
Yeah.
And I think the Astros fans look at the Red Sox and they're just sick of seeing big market, historic Boston in the playoffs.
Sure.
And Alex Cora is a cheat, and they never should have rehired him. We didn't go back to A.J. Hinch.
Right.
You know, so we're going to try to claim some sort of moral high ground over you in that way. You know, there are just a lot of things that line up for maybe some ugliness between the fan bases here, maybe a little more than what we saw previously.
It'll be interesting to watch, to say the least, more so than any other ALCS here.
The other subplot here, of course, is Dusty Baker.
Sure. Yeah.
Can Dusty Baker win his first World Series ring as a manager?
Yeah, right. It's been a long time knock on him. He's had good teams, different stops along the way.
Serial winner.
Right. Couldn't sort of get over the hump, right?
You know, as a guy who's been in baseball for 50 years, is regarded by a lot of folks as one of the coolest guys in the game.
People love playing for him, they say, right?
You know, and he's got like a personal Rolodex that you would not believe. I mean, you know, played with Hank Aaron.
Yeah.
You know, can get Bill Russell on the phone. He was talking about Bill Russell the other day and how did the Celtics win all those championships.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, how does Dusty Baker know Bill Russell?
Yeah,
well, he's that kind of guy.
He's been around forever. I remember watching him play with the Dodgers in the 70s. He was a good player.
Won a ring with the Dodgers in 81.
Yeah.
You know, so he does have one as a player. But, you know, as a manager, I think he should be a Hall of Famer already.
Yeah.
I certainly think he has more than enough credentials.
Just for the body of work. Yeah, but he's got to get the big one, right?
But if he wins a ring, I mean, he can go in there with his middle fingers extended and say, hey, guys, I should have been in a long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, where were you? I've been in the playoffs and in the World Series with multiple teams.
That's
like,
right.
You know, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But he is fascinating. And really, you know, if you want to talk about player-manager relationships, I don't know if there are many other teams that would be Cora and the Red Sox equal on that level.
But
I think Baker and the Astros
they
are
might
right
be.
There.
They might be.
Yeah,
that's
I think
good,
so.
That's a good point. All great reasons to watch the series, which starts Friday night down in Houston. 2-3-2 format, I believe. So 2 in Houston, 3 in Boston, last 2 back in Houston if needed. And who knows? But, Bill, we are going to be watching. We're going to be chatting as we do. And we will make sure we get back and do another Twin Bills after this series wraps up. Bill, as usual, thanks again.
Thank you, sir.